Welcome. We are delighted to present to you a set of conversations with the pollsters who give lots of insights into what the Europeans of the different generations, different segments of the societies think about politics, what drives them to lending their support in the elections, what politics should all be about in the future. Welcome to this very special episode of FEPS Talks, which belongs to the new series that focuses on polling in Europe, the social surveys. And we're trying to discover a little bit what the trends are, what people think, how people feel, and what it means for the progressivism. My name is Ania Skrzypek, I'm Director for Research and Training. And today, your and my guest is Kevin Cunningham, who is a lecturer in politics at TU Dublin and founder of Ireland Thinks, as well as the member of the Next Left Progressive Pollsters Network. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Delighted to be here, yeah.
Let's start from something, you know, very complicated, but perhaps home ground, recent elections in Ireland. I think we've debated that a little bit, that there's a lot of lessons to be learned from those elections that on one side can point to the particular aspects of the Irish partisan system. On the other hand, are also seeing some common trends for the other European countries.
Yeah, I think the really interesting thing and the reason why it's slightly unique was how the incumbent government did relatively quite well in a year in which incumbent governments did very, very poorly right throughout Europe and obviously in the United States. And this came at a time where the cost of living was also a major, major issue in many, many countries. And I think one of the lessons of this particular election was how a government that spent an enormous amount of money in successive budgets were able to minimize that as an issue. And with the minimization of that issue, they clearly benefited quite considerably. And there's a number of different data points to highlight this. You've got people who emphasize the importance of the economy in terms of their choice were falling in behind these two parties. You've got that decline, that very sharp decline of the cost of living as an issue, which corresponded, I think, quite interestingly, with when the government actually spent the money rather than when they communicated that they would do. So obviously they announce a budget and then subsequent to that, a couple of months later, they actually spend all that money on the voters. And I thought the most interesting thing about this was how the voters changed their mind when the money came into their pocket rather than when they heard about it. And I think it's maybe a reflection of how communications and campaign communications are only some part or perhaps an even weakening part of political discourse, where in fact, maybe an environment where voters have slightly less trust in politicians, that when they actually physically see it, they respond quite coherently towards towards financial incentives. And the other side of the coin here is that while Ireland is kind of behind on issues like immigration, it's only recently emerging, issues like housing have been a major part of Irish politics for almost a decade now, slightly ahead of the trend, I think, in European perspectives. And there's one subset of the electorate, the renters, the younger voters, who are increasingly disaffected with the government itself. And I think that's quite an interesting story because it shows how I think over time, as an issue like housing emerges, it becomes very difficult for governments to actually respond to that issue without upsetting other parts of its coalition. I think the government in Ireland, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who would be EPP and ALDE members, or Renew Europe members, sorry, they wouldn't necessarily see those younger voters and renters necessarily as part of their electoral coalition. They're generally fighting between each other amongst the kind of older voter. And I think as a result, it kind of shows that, you know, a government can actually do very well without actually winning these younger voters, which is a bit of a risk, I think, for you know, democratic accountability and everything else.
Indeed so. But before we talk about young people, I want to really get clarity on that, because what you're saying is pretty unusual for everywhere else. I mean, we've been seeing the elections where indeed you pointed to yourself, incumbent government had been struggling, especially last year, if not also earlier. And the policies you are discussing are the type of policies that when you start implementing them is one point, but before you see the lasting effects, it's a very long time. And you say, it's the policies and not the communication that have been key to the success. So is the delivery criteria understood in terms of political delivery criteria differently in Ireland?
I don't think so. I don't think that the voters in Ireland are any more skeptical of their political class. In fact, I think they're probably slightly more trusting of politicians comparatively. And I think that's probably just a legacy of it hasn't got to that stage of that cynicism in relation to the radical right emerging as a major feature. But I do think that like it is very much about this. If you looked at government approval rating in that most recent election compared to the previous one, it was a majority of people said the government had done a good or very good job. And then the previous election, I think it was like only 35 or 36% said that. So there's this big shift in people saying that they did very well and all this sort of stuff. And it is so closely linked to these economic outcomes. And you could also argue coming into, I mean, the election itself happened after the US presidential election. And there was already fears about the economic implications of a Trump government and the potential for tariffs. I mean, admittedly, all that sort of stuff actually did seem to transpire. But that was part of the narrative coming into the election. And those kind of economic concerns were underpinning. But I think because they were seen to have managed that cost of living crisis very, very well, that gave the government quite a lot of credibility coming into it, into the election about any other potential economic shocks. I think what's interesting for a left-wing perspective was that if you go further back, when this issue was very, very prominent in the 2022 and 2023, Sinn Féin kind of have moved, broadly speaking, political party connected with the left in Europe, obviously. But you'd probably argue that politically speaking and policy-wise, they're much closer to a centre-left party nowadays. Their voter base is broadly a kind of a working-class voter base, a kind of a traditional working class voter base that you might have seen in many European countries in the 80s and 90s. And their support went from around 39% in the polls in 2022, right down to 20%. And in the election itself, even lower again. And I think what's interesting about that is the fact that you could see these Sinn Féin voters were very, very keen on this cost of living issue. They seem to own that issue. But obviously it seems that an issue like the cost of living, it can be owned by one party one month, and then if the other party is more effective on it, it can just swing right across. And I think we've seen some of that in some of the other research that we saw today as well, how different parties in different countries can own the issue of cost of living, and it can vary quite considerably. In some cases, nobody owns it. I think Kaiser was pointing out how in Italy, no party seemed to own the issue, and then I think in Sweden, some parties did and some parties didn't. I think it's clearly an issue that's just not universally owned by the left, although clearly at some point, at least in Ireland, it was owned. The other thing obviously that happened was that while the cost of living declined, immigration rose as an issue. And this is, it's the last country, if not, I mean, I'm not sure how many other countries don't have a significant radical right, but obviously Ireland's relatively unique in terms of the absence of the radical right. And what seemed to happen there was a lot of voters went from Sinn Féin to independents. And I think historically speaking, that's that kind of the relative support levels for independent candidates in individual constituencies is much, much larger in Ireland than it is in other countries. And I think it's minimized the potential rise of a radical right in Ireland. I think that's the reason why they aren't necessarily there in Ireland. I think that's another interesting story in the election. And you know, potentially you could kind of see how in some elections in some jurisdictions, if they had the same electoral system, you might not necessarily have this same influence of the radical right. If there was an electoral system that allowed this kind of this independent localized voting where people are essentially voting for their local candidate because they've kind of given up on national politics.
But I would suggest that there is a great pluralism among those independent, that it's on one side, following the trend that you've mentioned, it doesn't give a lot of oxygen for the radical right to raise because also of the particular circumstances of the election and partisan system. On the other hand, localism would suggest that also there can be variety of political beliefs there.
There is a variety, and many people would believe I'm certainly simplifying it in this respect, and there are certainly left-wing independents, in many cases people who might have been members of the Labour Party and left subsequently, such as Catherine Connolly is a TD in Galway, who's to the left of the Labour Party, broadly speaking. But for the most part, this is where the voters are going, I guess. In some cases, the kinds of politicians that are espousing the same sort of rhetoric that you would otherwise see in a radical right party are the independent candidates, the ones who are emphasizing anti-immigration sentiment, being quite extreme sometimes in their rhetoric. They tend to be within that independent bloc, and it makes up most of it. Now, independents got in the last election, I think it was like 17% in total, if you include Independent Ireland in that block. Mm-hmm. And, you know, compare it, like maybe, I don't know, about 4 or 5% of that might be left wing. But of the ones that are not left wing, they're all quite significantly to the right, or at least to the right of the existing larger parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. So for me, at least, they take up that space. They were very popular as well in 2002 and 2005, mm-hmm. In that period. And that was the other time in which this was a much more significant issue in Irish politics, although it never bubbled up to like any significant political party again either.
What about the left? Because you've hinted a couple of times to the Labour Party, what's their situation now? You have two parties on the left right now.
Yeah, that's very true, yeah.
So
you have the Labour Party and you have the Social Democrats. Social Democrats emerged out of the Labour Party. A number of TDs were part of that government in 2016 and left subsequently and established this party. Social Democrats are very different, I would say, organisationally and in terms of their appeal. Social Democrats have a very strong appeal amongst young people, particularly young women. Their leader is a younger woman, and they are polling very strongly. They have a very strong national brand, I would say. The Labour Party, by contrast, and this is a slightly unique thing about Irish politics, is that partly people vote for candidates and partly they vote for parties. The Labour Party has a stronger legacy, I would say, of very strong candidates. And they've, on the basis of those very strong candidates they have, they still have a relatively strong party. So in some cases, one might be slightly stronger organisationally, I would say, perhaps the Labour Party, whereas the Social Democrats definitely have a stronger brand coming forward. And in over time, one would expect the Social Democrats to continue to develop as they get stronger and stronger candidates. And they've got, you know, a lot of people elected last time, and you know that's invariably going to rise even further. I mean, collectively, if you put those two parties together, they're only at a figure which is similar to what the Labour Party would have been at, you know, in the 90s or 80s. Ireland is very unusual in that the total support for centre-left and left-wing parties has been very, very low historically. But that has been changing in a trend completely different to other European countries, where the centre-left and left have been generally in decline, coming down to around 30% or so combined. In Ireland, they were at around 10%, and over the last couple of decades have been rising up to that same European average. So if you incorporate Sinn Féin, Social Democrats, Labour, and other small left-wing parties, they're kind of at a level which is quite similar to the European countries. So Ireland's kind of going a completely different direction for the last while to other European countries in terms of like an emergence of the left. And arguably, this is partly the result of, you know, this kind of combination of a decline in religiosity in particular. Mm-hmm. So working class areas, people would have historically voted for Fianna Fáil, a kind of centre-right party, mm-hmm. but very connected to the state and the establishment and the Catholic Church. And now almost all those voters are kind of have over time shifted back towards parties like Sinn Féin or the Labour Party in 2016. And that kind of emergence of the left in Ireland has been quite a feature. So like, you know, there aren't many people who would identify as being on the right. You would either identify as being on the left and support one of those left-wing parties, or in the centre and vote for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. So there isn't really a massive right, I think, in Ireland, which is kind of, again, unusual. But in some cases, there are lessons for broad European discourse. I think this independent thing is quite interesting, because we've always tried to wonder, how do you tackle the radical right, and what is it about it? And I think it gives a further insight into the type of voter and how other things can appeal to them. And then, as I said, the housing and cost of living issues, which are kind of interesting how they've developed there as opposed to maybe in other countries.
Well, it's a fascinating sort of mirroring of the situation, you know, like the different trends. Really, when you see Ireland versus many different countries in Europe, same was the question of the European election. Last European election, actually, you know, we are back at having the S&D representative from Ireland, while by many countries have sort of seen the representation decline. But you've mentioned a lot young people, and I haven't forgotten at all. It happened about 10 minutes ago, but I promised we would come back to this strategic point, because in many different countries we hear that on one side, it's very difficult to connect with young people. They are extremely volatile as a segment of the electorate, as also that there is a huge split gender-wise between young men and young women. So I'm wondering, you know, is Ireland an exception on that one as well somehow?
I would say, but I mean, broadly, they are a lot of young people do have very different views to older people in Ireland. I would say in terms of gender split, let's take it in the first case, there is a difference between younger men and younger women. When people are asked about their top issues, both would say housing. So broadly speaking, you could probably say on average, most of them are left wing and all this sort of stuff. But younger men, you know, the issue of immigration is much more prominent. It's perhaps as prominent amongst younger men than it is amongst other age groups, right? Whereas for younger women, it's not an issue at all. In fact, the issue of Israel and Gaza is a major issue. It's the second most important issue for younger women. So you have this very different, distinctive difference. And I think that difference in terms of issues really just highlights how, I mean, knowing that issue prevalence is somewhat determined by media consumption habits, it reflects how the media consumption habits of younger men and younger women are actually quite different. In other age groups, I think there isn't as much of a distinction. We can see that in some of the data, how people are consuming very different media amongst younger men and younger women, whereas in the older age groups, there isn't as much of a difference. So there isn't this kind of natural divergence. I would say one of the differences about Ireland, one of the reasons why it's slightly more left-leaning, I would say, on a whole range of issues, not least when you look at the attitudinal questions on immigration, is partly because its older population is different. So its older population is significantly more progressive, I would say, in terms of its values than in other comparative European countries. Now, while they would vote for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, it kind of anchors those two parties a little bit more towards that centre ground than it would otherwise in, let's say, for example, in the UK, where there's a very big difference between the older generation amongst Irish people and the older generation in the UK, where I think the Irish older generation would be significantly more left-leaning. So, for example, when you're looking at the, you know, the marches on Israel and Gaza and that sort of stuff, a lot of people, well, you would have a very strong younger female cohort. The next group, which would be very strong, would be older women and older men at these rallies. So that's why in Ireland, you do have this very dominant, you know, on that particular issue, that older generation are very pro Palestine, I'd say, if that's the way to describe that particular issue or simplify it.
Well, probably for the sake of the conversation, just to get the nuance. Yes, indeed. But let me ask you also, because, I mean, that already hooks into the global issues. We've spoken about the why the government has been so successful in convincing people that it's doing its job, which effectively feels, especially on the national, local level. We've spoken about the local choices when it comes to independence. Now you've tapped into the global issues. But what about the European Union? I mean, it has been missing so far in your story. And as far as anybody studying the European politics, we know that we ask the Irish citizens to vote pretty much on any big change in the referendum. So not always successfully right away. But it seems to be still a part of the public debate. So I'm wondering, you know, with all the questions about how the European Union is performing these days, how does it how are the sentiments today?
So I mean, there was a poll which asked people about their attitudes towards the European Union. There's one conducted by Red Sea for the European Movement on an annual basis, and they did report the lowest level of support for the European Union that they had in many, many years. Now, that still is an extremely high level of support. I think, like, maybe Luxembourg aside, or I think Ireland generally has the highest level of support. And again, this comes back to what I mentioned about that older demographic. Sorry, what was the other part of the question?
Well, because I mean, it links up with the expectations. I mean, in the European Union context, there's always this conversation now in this kind of very sort of complex global times. We need to get together. European Union dimension should be part of the partisan politics. So is that so for Ireland? Since we've discovered that there are so many diversities in between the Irish politics and everywhere else. So my question is a little bit in how far the European Union and pro-Europeanism is at all an argument in a political debate.
Yeah, I think universally parties would argue that they are pro-European. I mean, probably the biggest shift would be from Sinn Féin, who previously would have been campaigning on the no side of many of these referendums, but is very much now arguably a pro-European party. Now, they've been kind of conflicted a little bit more recently in terms of their positioning. They've been moving very much towards a kind of a centre-left model of a political party. And then this immigration issue, as I mentioned earlier, has kind of made them sort of rethink some of their repositioning on this. And I think in certain parts of the country, it's certainly a little bit different. But I think more generally, attitudes towards the European Union, at least in Ireland more generally, are a function of, the whole idea of output legitimacy and how it's perceived to be very effective at doing various different things, that the government itself doesn't necessarily have that same level of perceived competence, so there's a whole series. I mean, historically speaking, you might look at things like the building of infrastructure, which was very much dependent on European Union funds. The economic model of the Irish economy is increasingly dependent on multinationals, and that becomes this kind of interesting sort of nuance where on many issues the Irish public are quite progressive, and then when it comes to things like obviously corporation tax, there's a lot of support for low corporation tax because of this economic model, which is it's uncontested in Irish politics, really. But then in other issues, in other areas, I mean, you saw throughout COVID, that boosted support for the European project because it was perceived to be very effective in terms of the rollout of vaccines, which were, very widely supported in an Irish context. It wasn't the same, again, same sort of debate that you would have had, let's say, in the UK, which is the one that I can always kind of compare it against, over a whole variety of different issues, I guess.
Well, in that context, I mean, just to perhaps end the conversation with an outlook, because we've discussed the lessons from the elections and we've discussed what the current opinion polls are telling us. And also, you have brilliantly explained some of the nuances of why the Irish politics sometimes echoes the trends, but more than that is exceptional and unique in itself. So my question would be about looking into the future. You've mentioned cost of living crisis is an issue. The Middle East war and conflicts is a huge issue, a polarizing one. Migration is gaining traction. If you were to think, we would meet here in a year from now, what would you consider would be the next upcoming big issue? And I know I'm asking a lot because impossible. It's like, but this is what we, it's always this kind of a conversation, about now, but we want politics to be forward looking. So I'm wondering how we can do that.
The biggest upshot for me I do a lot of work in other European countries. And for me, the biggest distinction that I learned from this was, as I mentioned, this thing where clearly delivery matters quite a lot more than I might have anticipated. Clearly, it has a massive impact on voting behavior. And if I'm going to project forward and maybe from a European context, see what's happened maybe in Ireland and try to project forward in other European contexts, I can see the housing issue continuing to get bigger and bigger right across Europe. And I think perhaps, this is perhaps a more economic policy point, but I think one of the difficulties about housing is because it's such a labor intensive industry, and in many countries, they've relied quite heavily on immigration to fuel the construction industry. In the absence of that kind of type of immigration, now, I'm not saying that this is an economic policy I'd put forward, but it seems that housing itself is going to continue to get much more expensive. And you're going to continue to have these divisions in many countries, and the issue is not going to go away. And what I think is going to happen is further bifurcation of many European electorates, where you have this disaffected younger group who will be looking towards the left or the right, maybe in more and more extremes, to try to respond to an economic crisis for them. Coming back to, as I said, the basics of, you know, if they are not necessary, if they are having to pay increasingly larger and larger amounts of rent, they're going to be invariably disaffected, because that's what we can see now in politics. We can see that in the absence of communications, it is those nuts and bolts, the bread and butter, as we were talking about earlier, that matters the most. Now, the bread and butter in housing is so extreme in terms of those distinctions between those age groups. And what I think going forward is that this younger cohort is going to become increasingly disaffected. And perhaps, speaking to FEPS here, that perhaps this is the cohort that needs to be resolved. And perhaps housing, which is still an issue owned by the left, is the issue that it might need to, you know, win on.
Well, on that optimistic note of identifying an issue and the policy proposal, something that is so close to the progressive heart, I think it's my time to thank you so much explaining to us nuances of the Irish politics, and also for leaving us endowed with lots to ponder when it comes to the division, transfers of the different voters, the preoccupations of young voters, men versus women, but also preoccupation with idea of delivery and legitimacy criteria. Kevin Cunningham was yours and my guest. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
This series of podcasts is only part of the series of the FEPS Talks. You can find many of them pertaining democracy, socioeconomic dimension, digital, climate, foreign policy, gender equality, and many, many others via our YouTube channel. We wholeheartedly recommend all of them to your attention. We would be incredibly, incredibly grateful if you felt like intervening and leaving your comments behind. Thanks so much, and I do hope to see you online and hear soon from you in the future.